The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, delivering gourmet recipes and fresh ingredients right to your door. Listeners get their first three meals free at blueapron.com/takeaway. That's blueapron.com/takeaway.
Hey, everybody. This is The Takeaway for Friday, August 12th, 2016. Everybody have a nice weekend after you listen to this pod. And remember, you can talk to us at any point over this weekend. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE and leave a voicemail. Leave us a voice memo at takeawaydigital@gmail.com or find us on Anchor and get us there, too. Lots of ways to talk to us over the weekend, and we'll see you all on Monday.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. You might call this celebrating a laugh track from a torture chamber. Residents of the city of Aleppo cheering and drumming because a Damascus-backed government siege on the eastern part of the city for a month has been broken. For what? Well, the UN estimates that at least 250,000 civilians remain trapped in this sector of the city without food, medical supplies, or running water. Six times that are under similar need nearby Aleppo. 15 doctors sent a letter to the U.S. urging it to take action to open a permanent lifeline to bring in medical supplies. Here's John Kaler, a pediatrician from Chicago who traveled to Syria even though he knows government forces are targeting doctors. He went to Syria to work in an ER. He describes the situation.
After July 1, every day kind of blurred together. It was just, in the emergency room, it was just one person after another, child after child, after patient, and you never, you're so busy, you never really know who makes it, who's alive, who's dead.
Dr. John Kaler talking about his experience in Aleppo. In response, the U.S. and Russia have attempted to coordinate a paltry three-hour ceasefire in Aleppo to let aid through beginning this week. But as you will hear in this next conversation, a casualty of that so-called ceasefire was a man who once saved a baby in Aleppo and has emerged as the face of humanitarian need in that city, killed by a ceasefire. Stephen O'Brien is the Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator for the United Nations.
Well, I have spoken to a lot of people, whether I've been in just next to Syria in Turkey, next to the Baba Hawa crossing, where I've been in an orphanage and seen the faces of the children, amazingly resilient and always finding an opportunity to find something to smile about, but actually deep down hurting so badly because they've lost family, they've lost parents, and they are now left in a world without the guidance. So we're very dependent upon some wonderful and brave people, aid workers, whether they're in the neighboring countries and taking in people who have had to flee, or whether they are providing these basic services for people who suffered so much. And then when you go into Syria, you've got brave lorry drivers taking in the necessary life-saving goods and the medical facilities, and doctors who are absolutely determined, and nurses and ambulance drivers trying to get the people who are injured or have chronic conditions to get to the medical facilities which remain operating. But too many of them are being targeted and bombed and are being taken out of commission as a result. We've just had some terrible news overnight, and that is that there was a wonderful white helmet. You'll be aware these are local Syrian, very brave workers seeking to help support the people in their own country. The white helmet called Khaled Hara, who actually briefed the United Nations Security Council at last Monday's briefing on all this, and he's the one who's famous for his rescue of a baby in Aleppo. He was killed, I'm sorry to say, overnight. And this is when you ask me, who are the faces? Well, it's not just the ones I've met in Syria. This is a face who was on a screen briefing the whole of the Security Council. So he's a face known not just to me, but to the world. And he's now lost. It's terrible. It's grievous. And all this with political will and with real sheer determination for us to be able to have practical pauses to reach the needs of people. All this can be averted, and that's why we absolutely have to be relentless and undeterred, however difficult the fighting parties make it, for us to be able to do our work.
Is it the case that any doctor who goes into Aleppo these days is essentially on a suicide mission because medical personnel have been targeted?
Well, it's absolutely outrageous and unacceptable, and also against every humanitarian principle and law, international law, for any medical facility, medical personnel, or indeed aid worker to be targeted or killed. And there has been an increasing number of incidents where the parties to the fight have targeted and hit medical facilities, and doctors and medical personnel have been killed. As I say, this is unacceptable. It needs to be investigated immediately. It must be held to account, and there must be no impunity. I think that doctors who take a pledge to help others are selflessly putting their own lives at risk as they seek to save others. And it's absolutely our duty to do everything we can to try not only to protect them, to make sure they can do their absolutely selfless and important work, but at the same time, we must do everything we can to bring the fighting to an end so that all the civilians who are caught up in this long, protracted Syrian crisis, and particularly around Aleppo today, can at last get some relief from their terrible suffering.
What is the scale of the chlorine attack that we heard about this week, as far as you can tell?
Well, as far as I can tell, and you'll be aware that the United Nations and others have said that they are now conducting very rapid and important investigations into the allegations that there was a chlorine attack and that people have suffered grievously as a result in Aleppo. And, of course, the United Nations is doing everything it can to establish the facts and to make sure that the perpetrators are identified and that if that is proven on the evidence, that they are brought to account and that that is widely and publicly known.
Can the UN shield anyone in Aleppo at this point?
The United Nations is doing everything it can, both through the political process we have under the Secretary General's special envoy in seeking to get the parties to come together to talk and to find a way forward that is going to bring at last an end to this terrible suffering that has been raging across Syria now for years and has moved across many parts and continues to make the lives of about 13 million people almost unbearable. And particularly around Aleppo at the moment, we had been talking about the east over a number of weeks. It's now both the east and the west, so we're talking about the whole city of Aleppo. This is a population of well over 2 million people. You only have to think of some of the largest cities that gives you this, the idea of the scale, such as Paris or something like that, is now more or less encircled. You've got fighting raging at various parts. You've got proposals for some humanitarian pause, but not enough. And we have proposals to be able to get, and we're ready with the life-saving and protection to get into Aleppo, both east and west. But we have to have those long enough, safe pauses from the fighting. Ultimately, the best thing is for all the fighting to stop. But at the very least, we need 48-hour pauses to be able to help get our workers and the help in.
I read an account this year about how doctors in Aleppo, aware of the fact that they are targeted, set up clandestine emergency rooms and use digital and Bluetooth connections to try to assist each other in the various grisly skills they've had to learn to teach people how to perform operations in conditions that no doctor anywhere else in the world would even think of performing them, and that this amounts to a kind of wartime archive of humanitarian expertise that is unique to this Syrian conflict. Do you know of what I speak?
I'm aware of it. As you say, it's clandestine, so it isn't something that one can easily go and visit or see, but what I do know is that it is true that whenever you have terrible violence and conflicts around the world, that those wonderful, dedicated and committed professional medical personnel, be they doctors, surgeons, specialists or nurses and all those who give the care, they do learn to the ultimate degree both the extent of trauma care and treatment, and they are very innovative and, of course, very practical because they often have very little access to all the wonderful new technologies and materials which are available for those who are in peaceful settings and societies. And so, yes, this is something which just adds to the admiration that all of us have for those who stay and deliver these incredibly vital life-saving services to people in the gravest of need and vulnerability in these most terrible continuing conflict settings. And certainly in my visits to say Homs in Syria, I did visit a hospital where, despite having been bombed repeatedly, it was possible for them to be carrying out some of their activities down in the basement, but they had to effectively black out the windows, so there was no possibility of any of the fighting forces knowing that they were there, whilst they carried out, often by holding lamplights, very vital operations to treat often severe trauma. And as you know, there is an absolute requirement that once anybody is in a medical facility in need of medical treatment, even if that is a combatant being treated for wounds, they are protected under international law. They have a right to be able to access those services, and it is absolutely unacceptable and not anything that we could ever countenance is the idea that a medical facility can be targeted. Anybody in need of medical treatment should be able to avail them services of those wonderful, skilled people, even in times of war. Even wars have laws.
Mr. Undersecretary General, can you remind us of the individual who we lost last night?
His name is Khaled Hara, and as I say, he was the White Helmet, very well known now for his rescue of a baby in Aleppo, and he briefed the Security Council at last Monday's briefing. And my intense sadness at this grievous loss, and of course my condolences, and on behalf of the United Nations and all the people around the world who are represented by the United Nations, we send our deepest condolences to his family and his friends for this terrible loss.
Stephen O'Brien is United Nations Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator. Stephen O'Brien, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to the anthem and flag of No Nation, under which 10 athletes are competing in this year's Rio Olympics. They were selected to send a message of hope to all the refugees of the world, all 65 million of them. But just like in the world at large, these athletes are merely an easily overlooked symbol.
Well, in lane number one, as you mentioned, Remy Annis is now residing in Belgium. Place of birth was Syria.
25-year-old Rami Annis, who fled Aleppo in 2011, got a standing ovation this week after setting a personal best in the men's 100-meter freestyle, although it wasn't enough to qualify for the semifinals.
Traveling with Mardini off the blocks from the refugee Olympic team. Incredible story for her, even getting to these Olympic Games. She's finished seventh in a 105, so a good performance for her. We won't see her through to the semifinals. As of the next heat, it will start to get very fast.
That's an announcer talking about Syrian refugee Yusra Mardini, who won her 100-meter butterfly heat, although both that time and her 100-meter freestyle time weren't quite enough to move on. This year, her personal best in the 3.5-hour swim in the Mediterranean, however, that saved her life and the life of her family, was plenty enough to get her to Lesbos in Greece, where she is now a refugee. Over the weekend, the track and field events will kick into high gear, where we'll see 21-year-old Angelina Nadai Lahalith from South Sudan. She'll compete in the women's 1500-meter heats on Saturday, and South Sudanese runner James Chenjek will compete in the men's 400-meter heats on Sunday. In each case, for these refugee athletes, their competitive event mirrors a personal journey to safety that no national team member could match. For all of the refugee teams, survival is a more precious and solid medal than gold. The Takeaway wishes them all the very best of luck.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
That well-publicized Russian hack of the Democrats has reached much further into the party than what was initially perceived, The New York Times reported this week. The hack appears to have compromised even more organizations and over 100 personal email accounts. Gordon Carrera is the BBC security correspondent and author of Cyber Spies, The Secret History of Surveillance, Hacking, and Digital Espionage. Oh, Gordon, I am so thrilled to have you on the program. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So Anne Applebaum of The Washington Post told us last month that this was, she just boldly said this, this was so characteristically Russian that we might as well be Ukrainians covering an election in Kiev. Do you agree?
Oh, I think what's so interesting about this is it's Russia using, it seems, new technology, cyber hacking, to do something which it's done for many decades, which is active measures, influence operations. That's what the KGB, when it was still around, called this kind of work in the Cold War, which was to try and get hold of information, propaganda, sometimes disinformation, and to spread it out, to discredit your opponents or to try and influence politics and public opinion in other countries. That's something that the Soviet Union, the KGB, was very active at doing in the Cold War. And cyberspace, new technology, hacking just offers a new way to do that effectively, to try and get hold of information and to spread it out very efficiently sometimes by getting hold of large amounts of information. So I think you can see the way in which they're really just using technology to do something that they've characteristically done for many decades and do it in an effective way.
All right, so the hacking, that may be a little bit high tech, but the scheduling of the leaks, the precise timing of the leaks, that's classic Soviet-style KGB. Vladimir Putin learned that probably in his first week in training. And so we can expect the timing of more leaks to go along with, say, a week before the debates, something like that, or a week after the debates. What would you think?
You'd think so, yes. Although I think one of the things the Russians are quite careful to keep just slightly distanced from it, to have a level of plausible deniability. And you'd see that as well with intelligence operations in the Cold War. So they won't necessarily leak it themselves. They might use it, give it to a third party, who might then give it to someone else to get it out there. And so in this case, it might be WikiLeaks, who may or may not know the original source of the information. And so they may not necessarily have total control about how it emerges and when, partly because they want that level of deniability. And cyberspace does make it easier to do that, because you don't necessarily have to meet someone or physically steal the secrets yourself, because you can do it remotely. But in this case, that the trail of information that security firms have been able to watch does seem to point back to Russia as the origin of this hack. And interestingly enough, in some cases, rival parts of the Russian intelligence infrastructure, who might have even been inside the DNC separately. And also one of those groups also involved in some very other interesting hacks, for instance, of a French TV channel just last year, which suddenly broadcast an image from ISIS, which and claimed to be from the cyber caliphate. Well, actually, it looks like the Russians might have been behind that as well. And that in the Cold War in the old days would have been called false flags, where you do something and you pretend it's someone else doing it. So again, you can see how spies use cyberspace to do things they've always done, but just in some innovative ways.
So let's parse this by now pretty famous claim on the part of Donald Trump. Listen.
Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing. I think you will probably be rewarded mightily by our press.
Now, Trump, of course, is famous for BS, total BS. Nevertheless, this sets down a marker that may, in fact, play directly to competition between hackers inside Russia who say, oh, those 30,000 emails, well, maybe the KGB can't find them, but we can find them. And actually, we know a back channel in France where we could find them. And something could actually emerge from a ridiculous statement like this.
I think it's quite possible that once lots of people knew that those emails were out there and they were on private servers, I think you'd have seen lots of intelligence agencies and hackers and activists, non-state actors, try and go after them. I think that's the reality. And often you will have multiple intelligence agencies trying to get inside a system. And we've seen them try and get inside political parties, presidential campaigns, going back a few cycles, you know, at least the last couple of presidential election cycles, to try and see what they could find. So I think you're likely to have multiple, you know, actors, yes, trying to get inside and find this. And they may have been doing that already. I think what was perhaps different about the DNC hack was releasing the information, you know, the kind of of classic espionage is you try and find things out because you want to know about it. But releasing information is more akin to kind of this idea of influence operations or active measures where you're trying to change behavior by making it public. And I think that's what was quite interesting. And that's the thing to look out for. And that's where perhaps Russia has been pushing the boundaries of what was considered normal cyber espionage in the last few years in all kinds of ways. And I think this looks like just one of them.
I think we also have to retune or re-engineer our assessment of alarm in the case of the Russians doing this sort of thing. I mean, it is not the era of the Cold War anymore. And there are Russians living in the United States. I mean, there are millions of them. They're voters. In many ways, this might be more akin to the way in which Israel tries to influence elections in the United States as opposed to some, you know, ancient 1960s era Cold War influence. I mean, this is the sort of thing that goes on nowadays, yes?
Well, yes, you're right. And don't be surprised if you discover that the US and the UK might be spying on other countries' elections. But influencing them and trying to influence them, that's a slightly different ballgame. And I think that there's trying to do that covertly, I think, is the kind of thing which can also backfire. And I think that's perhaps what might be happening is you will get then pushback because people don't like the perception that another country might be influencing their elections. And it can end up being quite counterproductive. But yes, we are in a new world of cyber espionage, of information operations, of information warfare, in which information is being weaponized, stolen, used, and it's being used by companies, by individuals, by governments against each other, by non-state actors against each other. And I think it's certainly something we're going to have to get used to in the future.
Gordon Carrera, BBC security correspondent and author of Cyber Spies, The Secret History of Surveillance, Hacking, and Digital Espionage, finding himself hard at work covering the U.S. presidential election. Gordon, thanks so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, who knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals. Blue Apron works with a community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, sustainable fisheries, and ethical ranchers to deliver perfectly portioned seasonal ingredients and easy-to-follow recipe cards right to your door. Choose recipes based on your preferences with no weekly commitment. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
The sense that I got from the commanders and the fighters on the front line is they're ready.
That's Christopher Miller in eastern Ukraine. I'm John Huckenberry. This is The Takeaway. He's telling us that the tripwires between Ukrainian and pro-Russian forces are as tight as they've ever been and that anything could happen now. Christopher Miller is based in Ukraine for Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. He's just been embedded on the front lines with Ukrainian troops and says that along with 40,000 troops now mobilized on the Crimea-Ukraine border, the calm of the last few years appears to be coming to an end.
Ukraine has been put on a war footing with the recent events in Crimea just these past couple of days, and the Russians accusing Ukraine of sending in special forces. Just in the last 24 hours, we've heard the president say that he's putting the entire country on high alert. More soldiers have been moved to the front lines in eastern Ukraine, and new battalions and divisions have even been moved now to the south near the administrative border of Crimea.
What's the condition of the airport in Donetsk and other infrastructure in Donetsk? Has it been rebuilt, and is it now going to be reused as a base of operations?
No, I don't imagine that the airport will be used for any coming and going, at least not in the near or even distant future. It's completely destroyed. It's built in 2012. It was this beautiful glass structure, symbol of modern Ukraine and moving forward toward Europe, and it's just been completely destroyed, and there's very, very little left.
Is there a sense in which this mobilization is designed to take specific territory, or is it simply a return to a kind of chaos that we saw a year and a half ago?
You know, with the exception of one incident in the last couple of months in which a Ukrainian battalion by the name of Idar pushed forward 1 kilometer and seized a little bit of new territory. We haven't seen any forward movement by either side. It's mostly just shooting back and forth, that shooting back and forth intensifying. So rather than small caliber weapons, Kalashnikov rifles, smaller mortars, we're seeing heavy mortars, we're seeing heavy weapons, and even in several cases over the last couple of weeks, the return of surface-to-surface rockets called Grad translates to hail, being used on the front line and falling down not only on military positions on both sides, but also civilian areas of the region.
Christopher, would you say that the morale and the sort of heated passions of the Russian-speaking majority, I guess, in eastern Ukraine is at the same level of height and has been put up to the sort of level of militancy that we saw a year and a half ago? And is the morale on the Ukrainian side ready to sort of engage in an all-out war here?
Worryingly, yes. The rhetoric has also increased along with the fighting. Passions are very, very hot right now, hotter than I've seen in the last 10 or 12 months. The sense that I got from the commanders and the fighters on the front line is they're ready. They believe that their military is much stronger than it was at the beginning of the conflict. They're much more organized. They're getting a lot more help from the government. And right now, the battalions and the men on the front line are some of Ukraine's most seasoned and skilled fighters.
Christopher Miller is a reporter based in Ukraine for Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty. He just returned from the front lines in eastern Ukraine, embedded with Ukrainian special forces. Thank you so much, Christopher.
Thank you for having me.
As I mentioned, you know, there are millions of Russians in the United States legally with all kinds of opinions about this election, about the international situation. They also happen to live in places where the Trump name is plastered on high-rise buildings all over the skyline. Take Sunny Isles Beach in Dade County, Florida, called Little Moscow. The Russian community there, particularly business owners and people who live in Trump buildings, just love the Donald. Someone who can personally testify to this is Marika Odden, who's a reporter with WLRN. Marika, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. Hello.
Do they buy the stories that you know, Trump is involved with the oligarchs, or that Putin prefers Trump, or that there's some sort of direct connection with the hack that's taken place of Democratic emails?
They didn't really tell me that they were buying the story that there was a direct connection. But what they certainly do think and do feel like is that Vladimir Putin would prefer Trump to be president. They feel that there are similarities between them, that they like each other, that they get along well, and that they have the same interest. And that would be better relations between Russia and the United States. So with the people in Sunny Isles Beach who I talked to, those comments that Trump made about possibly lifting the sanctions, about recognizing Crimea as Russian, the annexed Ukrainian peninsula, that goes down very well with the people there. And they want the sanctions to go away because their business there really depends on Russian tourists coming in, on Russian people investing in the area.
I believe that most of the Russians probably will vote for Trump. The reason being is that they know what he did, what he achieved. They know he's a person that likes to achieve his goals.
So there's a domestic angle and there's a sort of personality angle. Who's that who's speaking and who does he represent, do you think?
Well, that is Eli Nektarlov. His agency, he has 100 agents and 70 of them are Russian speakers. So that's quite a lot. And he's worried because his business is not going so well these days. And he's supporting Trump because he feels that that would be very good for Russian-U.S. relations. He wants the sanctions to be lifted by the United States. But he also feels that Trump would be a great president because he feels that as a businessman, Trump knows how to run a country. And he told me that he feels that because Trump has been all over the world, he would probably take the best of what the world has to offer and introduce it in the United States.
Interesting perspective. And Nektarlov there with his army of real estate agents, you might say one of them here, Ann Abraham, is kind of a canvasser for Trump on some level. Listen to this.
They both very strong and solid leaders. They both very straightforward, very powerful inside. You know, it's a kind of power that you even feel like when you watch the TV, you already feel it. And they both very great negotiators. And I think they kind of like each other.
Exactly what we heard here in New York. Who is Anne Abraham, and does she represent a group of people who votes?
Anna Abraham is a green card holder, actually. She came to the United States, she told me, 7 years ago from the Russian city of St. Petersburg. And she feels very sorry that she cannot actually vote for him this time. And she drew this line between Vladimir Putin and Trump. So she feels they could get along and that they could together do a lot of good for the United States, which she considers home. And actually also Eli Nikhtalov considers home. So they're very invested into the fate of the United States, and they do feel that Trump would be a great choice.
Do you think in a close election in Florida that this constituency would have any voter power to move the needle one way or another?
That's very hard to say. According to U.S. Census 2010, just over 7% in that area were Russian-speaking. It's also not clear how many of them actually can vote, because you have people that come here and stay, but you also have people who have invested in a second home, maybe. They're scared away by the visa ban that is in place for some Russians due to the Ukrainian conflict. They're scared by banking restrictions that have been placed on some Russian banks. So even those Russians who are not affected by those sanctions, they are scared away by hearing a lot of rumors, and that's their main concern.
Marijke Auden, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Some great reporting there from Marijke Auden, who's a reporter with WLRN in Miami.
I'm Julia Child. Bon appetit.
Never underestimate the power we women have to define our own destinies.
You can't even get a decent bagel in Washington.
Many men have underestimated me before.
Everything goes for my baby!
You're wearing a sweater that was selected for you by the people in this room.
As long as you all are under my roof, things are going to be done my way, starting now.
I have doubts.
We can give them heat, energy, give them a war hero with heart, forged by enemy fire in the desert in the dark.
But they will rue the day.
Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, the wacky side of blank.
Meryl Streep.
Yes, indeed. Wow, listen to all that.
She's
I mean, that
great.
Could have gone on for hours.
Yeah.
Hours.
She's amazing.
Hours and hours. And she's amazing again. Well, I mean, I don't know if the movie's amazing, but it is an amazing idea, and that she will do anything. I mean, what a party girl, Meryl
yes.
Streep.
Yes,
you know
indeed.
What I mean? Let's hear this Florence Foster Jennings clip, and then you can set up the movie for us.
Please, Mr. Bayfield, we'll be murdered out there.
You think that I'm not aware of that? For 25 years, I have kept the mockers and scoffers at bay. I'm very well aware of what they might do. But Florence has been my life. I love her, and I think you love her, too. Hmm? Singing at Carnegie Hall is her dream, and I'm going to give it to her. The only question now is whether you will stand by your patron and friend in her hour of need, or whether you will focus on your ambition.
Hugh Grant having an amazing amount of fun.
Yes.
Being the, well, patron helper fellow of Florence Foster Jenkins, who's got to be the worst singer on planet Earth.
Yes, indeed. A real person, wealthy socialite who lived in New York. And she was so bad that she sold out Carnegie Hall. She recorded herself singing opera. She thought she was a coloratura, but she was actually a horrible singer. Meryl Streep plays her in this film. Amazing, very odd, true story. And this is a great comedy by Stephen Frears, a director I love, who did The Queen.
Mm-hmm.
Meryl Streep is great as this dowdy woman who can't hear what we're all hearing when she sings these ear-splitting notes. She thinks she sounds wonderful. She gains a cult following, and like I say, she eventually sells out the famous Carnegie Hall. Practice, practice, practice. And and Hugh Grant, I have to say, in this movie, I know we all love Meryl Streep, you know, this incredibly decorated, most nominated actress. Hugh Grant owns this movie.
Really?
He is amazing in it, and I would be stunned if he doesn't get his first Oscar nomination as
wow.
her husband. He's just fantastic. So much fun.
Well, that will improve his mood.
Yes, indeed.
He's been so down on the world lately. He needs,
yes.
He needs a few laughs. Well, that's great. And do they work well together as actor, actress?
They work wonderfully. I mean, they're terrific together. And it's such an interesting story because they had this very unusual relationship. He was a bit of a hound dog. So perhaps that's why this role is so good for Hugh Grant. But, you know, but yet they loved each other. And he doted on her, waited on her hand and foot, even though he also kept a mistress on the side. That's one of the more interesting things about the movie.
So this next film, Sausage Party, asks the question, can all food have an animated feature?
You're all alive and looking at me with your gloves and your little shoes and your arms and your legs.
Legs? Oh. Huh? Look at me. Look at me. You ate my damn legs.
Oh, no, not Mr. Pizza. I've eaten so many of your family members. I've committed pizza genocide. Mr. Sausage, when will it end?
When will it end? When he stops drinking us.
Yeah!
And when he stops using us.
A movie about sausage.
It had to be made, John.
Okay.
This is basically a Pixar spoof from Seth Rogen, Evan Goldberg, who did Superbad, and others. You've got basically a bunch of food items living in a supermarket. They think that when the humans come to pluck them and take them home, that they've been chosen. They're going to a better place. And of course, they discover that when they get home, their eyes are being gouged out. If they're potatoes, if they're sausages, they're being sliced.
Didn't they look around the supermarket and see the dead chickens and the...
There is a wonderful cart crash scene in this animated film that basically redoes the D-Day invasion and Saving Private Ryan.
Oh, great God. Scene.
I have to say.
You like this?
I thought this was very,
oh, my
very
God.
Funny.
It's, no.
It is reductive and offensive, but I laughed throughout the whole thing, and I thought it was great. Great voice cast. Edward Norton, oddly enough, playing Sammy Bagel Jr. A lot of great touches in this film. I had a real blast at it.
Pepperidge Farm Goldfish, the movie about them is
no,
not far
no
behind.
Goldfish. No goldfish.
No, but
good
that's
call.
Next.
That's got to be
that's
next.
Next. All right. Movie number three is actually a serious release. Pete's Dragon. This is Disney, right?
Yes.
I guess you heard about the boy.
I did. No word travels fast in this town. How long has he been out there?
6 years.
6 years? Nobody can survive in that forest for 6 years. At least not alone.
Well, he says... He says he wasn't alone. He says it's his friend from the forest. And it reminded me of...
I know what it reminded you of.
So that's about the only realistic... cinema realistic scene in this entire movie, right?
Well, you know, this is a remake of the old Disney film from 77, Pete's Dragon, which was a musical, a fun, lively musical, and the dragon was this sort of goofy imaginary friend who was ink and painted into the live action. This is a much more serious, much more dramatic version. The dragon is now CGI, massive, giant, green-furred creature.
I've heard it's a monster tearjerker.
It is. It really is. I have to say, I think this film is a little bit on the hokey side, maybe a little bit too serious and intense for younger viewers. But even though it is a little corny, I have to admit, it just reduced me to a puddle by the end.
Really?
And I think it's the director, David Lowry, who did Ain't Them Body Saints. He's got this kind of Spielbergian touch. He loves these grand vistas of nature, and it works. It worked on me. Despite my best efforts to resist, it worked.
Something about those little boys on the shoulders of big monsters with wings.
Right, exactly. And that's Robert Redford, of course, as the only guy who has actually seen the dragon before. So the young boy and the grandpa figure make a connection there.
How did he look? Better than Spock in Star Trek?
Yes, he did.
He did? Sorry, that's terrible.
Ouch.
Well, no, Spock looked okay. I mean, Redford, you know.
Redford. No, you know, he's still holding up.
Yeah.
He looks good, you know. And this is a small role for him, but it's a nice role. And, I liked the movie, even though I tried to be a grouch. I tried not to cry, but it didn't work.
Try to be a grouch. Three winners this week.
Three winners.
You failed miserably at being a grouch, Rafer Guzman.
End of summer. End of summer. Great week for end of summer, surprisingly.
Film critic for Newsday. Thank you so much, Rafer. Have a great weekend.
You too, John. Thanks.
Back to what we were talking about a moment ago with Rafer Guzman. When it's so bad, it's good. Any of you old enough to remember Tiny Tim, the singer, the star? Oh, God, he's awful. He was a star. He was a big star. Similarly, Florence Foster Jenkins isn't an anomaly in music or stardom. A whole genre has been created to encompass music outside of the commercial industry, often by individuals with no formal training who choose to reject conventional rules and notes, for that matter. It's called outsider music. And the takeaways, Rafer Guzman listened to the unlistenable so we wouldn't have to. Actually, so we can with him. And the recordings are so bad. People who thought they were good. Oh, just listen.
Stop there.
There's work to be done. But you've never sounded better.
That's Meryl Streep as Florence Foster Jenkins in the new film of the same name. Foster Jenkins was a wealthy New York socialite who fancied herself an opera singer. Unfortunately, she could barely sing at all. She had a piercing voice, a wild pitch, and a violent sense of rhythm. Yet, sing she did, relentlessly, until she achieved her dream. On October 25th, 1944, Florence Foster Jenkins sold out Carnegie Hall. That's the real Foster Jenkins murdering Mozart on a 78 RPM disc, which is now a collector's item. It's an early example of what we now call outsider music. That's a loaded term aimed at cultural insiders and snobs. After all, who are we to say what's bad or good? Stravinsky's Rite of Spring was booed in 1913. Today we call it a work of genius. Could it be that we're the ones who are tone deaf? Let's consider some of the other outsider musicians who followed in Foster Jenkins' footsteps. Would you believe that song was a minor hit in 1966? It's from a California housewife who sang as Mrs. Miller. She actually got signed to Columbia Records. She later claimed she was conducted out of sync and only her worst takes were chosen. Mrs. Miller was an outsider, all right, but an artist? Compare that one-hit wonder to the prolific recluse known as Jandek. In 1978, Jandek released his first album, Ready for the House. Reportedly, two people bought copies, and this is what they heard.
I keep repeating, it takes a beating to go naked in the afternoon.
Nevertheless, Jandek had his fans. He released two more albums in 1981, three in 1982, and has now released more than 70 albums. He never performed live until 2004, and today he tours fairly often. Jandek has become a cult hero to generations of DIY rockers. But the most famous outsider musicians are probably the Shags, three sisters who released their first and only album, Philosophy of the World, in 1969.
I'm so happy when you're near, I'm so sad when you're away. I've been happy almost every day, now that you're here to stay. But when you have to leave, then I'll die.
The Shags displayed such a high level of ineptitude that it began to resemble brilliance. Terry Adams, the jazz pianist, discovered their album years later and re-released it to widespread acclaim. The music press called the Shags avant-garde, primitive rock, the first punk band. Frank Zappa called them better than the Beatles. But Carla Bley, the jazz composer, put it best when she said, "They bring my mind to a complete halt."
My pal's name is Football, he always likes to roam. My pal's name is Foot. I never find him home. I go to his house, knock at his door.
Outsider musicians might be brilliant, or they might just be bad. But actually, that doesn't matter. What's important is that they had the will and the determination to make themselves heard. These days, you don't hear so much about outsider music because there's no longer an outside. Now we have social media, so everyone has equal access to an audience. Here's an R&B singer named Ice JJ Fish, who scored a YouTube hit with his song, On the Floor.
It's something about the girl that just makes my head wanna twirl. Oh, you got me want to tell all them other girls.
The video for that tune has been viewed more than 49 million times.
If Florence Foster Jenkins were alive today, just imagine how many ears she could have reached.
It is true that a lot of singers my age are on the decline, but I seem to just get better and better.
I know, it's hard to believe, isn't it?
Well, I am so blessed.
For The Takeaway, I'm Rafer Guzman.
More and more people are using more and more of the ocean, so the pressures have ramped up.
It's a living soup.
I realized I came across more plastic bags than fish.
We've really altered sound in the ocean.
Below that depth, in the dark.
The more science we do, the bigger and bigger this problem appears.
Why aren't we cleaning this up?
It secures our place in the universe, on the planet. It keeps us alive. Protecting nature is the best investment we can make.
A week-long love song and learning session about the ocean, how human behavior is changing the oceans, how the efforts made to conserve two-thirds of the Earth for generations to come are going. We'll kick it off with renowned oceanographer and National Geographic explorer in residence and my personal hero, Sylvia Earle, who's devoted her life to inspiring public awareness of how to save our oceans. Her solution is to give nature a break, create safe spaces for bodies of water in a similar way we do on land.
The idea of protecting our life support system makes a lot of sense. It started out with national parks thinking about landscapes, places that were protected because of their beauty and because people could really be restored in body and spirit for recreation and otherwise. But now in this new century, the second century, we have another opportunity. There's a blue country out there, 200 miles from the coast out into the sea where this country has jurisdiction, and it's an area bigger than the land that we think of as our country. Blue parks. It's an idea whose time is really overdue, if anything. And it's now. And whether it's in this country or around the world, science-based conservation, understanding why these places matter. With every breath we take, with every drop of water we drink, we're connected certainly to the ocean, but to nature generally. It underpins everything else that we care about.
The voice of oceanographer Sylvia Earle. You'll hear more from her and others in our series all about the oceans next week on The Takeaway.
Baby, bye, bye.
I love this game.
Baby, bye, bye.
And I love this team. And today, bye, bye. I'm saying goodbye to both.
No, we are not going to waste our time by bemoaning the departure of that flawed baseball legend, A-Rod. It's a real legend we must say goodbye to today. For 6 years on this program, you may have noticed a certain proclivity toward rather British topics. You may have also noticed that 6 years ago, this show was stuck with a paltry 50 or so stations on the verge of cancellation, whereas today, nearly 300 stations air us, and we are, I dare say, a hit. We had a secret weapon. Codename Rupert.
This is Rupert. He's a very extraordinary fellow, Rupert. He's a sort of one-man army all by himself. Let me show you what happens when Rupert hits the ground.
Yes, just as in that famous clip from the movie The Longest Day, Rupert helped us win the war. Our legendary executive producer, Rupert Allman, moves on to other conquests. We wish him well. Think, and we pray for The Takeaway without it. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.